KUOW podcasts are made possible by listener support. Become a new or renewing member today at KUOW.org.
From 94.9 KUOW Seattle, this is Weekday. I'm Marcy Silman. Investigators are still looking into Saturday's crash of a Boeing 777 in San Francisco. What does this accident mean for the airplane maker's future? We're going to talk about Boeing and specifically its future in the Puget Sound region. That conversation just after 10 o'clock. Also coming up after 10, Nancy Pearl with recommendations for younger readers. Congress is back in Washington, D.C. after its 4th of July break. On the docket this week, student loans as well as money for Egypt. Joining us to preview the week ahead in Washington is Jill Jackson, Capitol Hill producer for CBS News. Good morning, Jill.
Good morning, Marcy.
Let's start with Egypt. The situation there politically is still chaotic, and that concerns Congress, I'm sure, on the philosophical level, but also financially. What is our tie financially to Egypt at this point?
Well, Washington approves funding each year for aid to Egypt. It's $1.5 billion. It's been something that a lot of lawmakers have been uncomfortable with since Morsi was elected, and they've been monitoring events there. But now that there's been this event that some call a coup and some call the people's will, essentially, that there's going to be a huge debate as to whether that funding can continue, because it's actually against the law for the United States to continue funding a government that has a government if it is the result of a coup.
So when a democratically elected leader is overthrown, that's considered to be a coup, correct?
Exactly.
So this is a little murkier because, as you mentioned, some see it as the execution of the people's will as opposed to a military coup. How much support is there, do you guess, for continued aid to Egypt at this point?
I think that there is still significant support for continued aid, mostly because I think there is a fear that the United States could cause more damage by not being as involved as we are now in that country. It's a very slippery slope. You have the chairman of the House Intelligence Committee, Mike Rogers, who said yesterday on the Sunday talk shows that he thinks we should continue supporting the military in Egypt, since that is clearly the only stable force there. But then you do have some vocal opponents of continuing aid, including Senator John McCain, who says, you know, this was absolutely a coup. They overthrew a democratically elected government. He blames the United States for that and says it's because of a lack of leadership on the Obama administration's part. But he says that the facts are the facts and that aid should be discontinued.
How quickly is Congress expected to act on this issue?
Well, at the moment, current funding bills will expire at the end of September, which is the end of the fiscal year. So there are some months that they have to grapple with this. It's very clear that the administration, by not calling this a coup, they're trying to keep their options open. But I think that the Congress would have to specifically put language in that would state that would bar funding for Egypt, so that the administration does not move accounts around and do that anyway. But I think it's going to be a heated debate over the next couple months for sure. And I expect just even this week a lot of action. I'm sure we will have briefings, though they have not been announced yet, trying to keep Congress in the loop of what's going on in Egypt and what the United States' plans are in terms of responding.
We're talking with CBS News Capitol Hill producer Jill Jackson. On Wednesday, I know the Senate plans to take up the fate of student loan interest rates. A July 1st deadline to decide what to do about these student loans came and went, which effectively allowed interest rates to double, as I understand it.
That's right. It's on new loans, so that's an important distinction. If you have a loan, if you've had a loan already, your interest rate will stay at the 3.4%. But if you want to get a Stafford loan now, it's going to double. It will be at double that rate. The Senate is expected to take up a one-year extension of the 3.4% rate this week. However, Senate Republicans are vowing to filibuster that. Republicans in Congress in general are very much against doing another year extension. They feel like it's just a Band-Aid solution, that we'll have to deal with this again next year. The House had passed has passed its own bill. They passed it in May. That would basically tie student lending rates to the United States borrowing rate. So basically, if you were going to take out a loan, depending on what the rate is that year for the country, your loan rate could change. Now, that rate would be capped at 8.5%, but that's well over the 6.4%, and so that is why Democrats oppose it. They say that, you know, this bill is actually would cut the deficit by $3.7 billion, and that's basically trying to balance the budget on the backs of students, and they say that is unacceptable. House Republicans, however, are saying, look, we're the only ones who've acted here. The president wanted a market-based solution. We gave him that. They're going to hold a rally today on the House steps with students trying to really hammer home the point that they've acted and the Senate has not. And they're going to keep that pressure on the Senate. The Senate is going to need to pass something, though, if the two sides are going to reach some sort of compromise, which I think that most lawmakers want something before the August recess, because school starts in September or even late August for a lot of folks. They need to make decisions about what they're going to do, and the interest rate could affect that decision. So this has a real impact on just regular people.
Has the Senate taken its time doing this because it doesn't have the 60 votes it might need to override any kind of filibuster?
That's part of it. The Senate Republicans don't want that one-year extension. Originally, the Senate Democrats wanted to do a two-year extension of the 3.4% rate. There was a group led by Senator Manchin from West Virginia that was trying to hammer out a big compromise before this July 4th recess. But I think mainly the problem was the Senate was so completely focused on immigration reform and their big comprehensive bill that took them weeks to pass, that really they came up to the July 4th recess and didn't really have the time left to hammer out a deal on student loans. So everyone said they would go on their home to for the 4th of July break, come back, and fix it retroactively. And so the Senate, we'll see what the Senate is able to pass, if anything, this week. But that's clearly the hot potato is in their court at the moment.
We're going to come back to immigration reform in just a second. I just have to touch on what you mentioned, which was the Obama administration calling for something tied to the market rate. Is what the Obama administration has proposed identical to what the House passed, or is it different?
Well, it is different. So it has a variable rate plan, but they want a rate that's tied to market forces. So what the House did there, the administration would be fine with. Their problem is with the cap being so high at 8.5% of the loan. So what the administration has proposed is that you would actually cap the rate at based on the student's income. So the lower your income, the lower your rate would be paying back that student loan. It could still have some variability. There would be, you know, it would not be the same certainty you have today with that low 3.4%. But it's important to remember that rate was put in place by the Democrats as sort of a stimulative measure during the recession. And so in some ways it was never meant to be permanent. And at this point, starting this year anyway, both the administration and House Republicans wanted some sort of reform of the student loan process. But it's looking like, at least in the Senate, the easiest thing is just to continue with what we have now. But we'll see what they're able to pass.
You mentioned that the Senate was busy working on its immigration reform bill, which passed with bipartisan support. Increased border security was included, also a path to citizenship. But House leaders said that was all well and good, but they were going to craft their own measure. So where are we when we look at the House of Representatives and immigration reform?
Well, we are in a wait-and-see mode on immigration in the House. As you said, the Senate passed their large comprehensive bill, and Speaker Boehner immediately said that the House would not take that package up. The Majority Leader Eric Cantor told members over the recess in a memo that it's possible they could start taking up immigration measures as soon as this month, but that's a big could. So the big thing everyone's anticipating this week is on Wednesday, the House Republican Conference will meet in the afternoon behind closed doors. They will have a session where the chairman of the House Judiciary Committee, who's been shepherding small piecemeal immigration packages through his committee, will kind of go over what he has, what his committee has already done. So they've passed, for instance, a bill that would reform the agricultural worker visa program, the skilled worker visa program, a bill that would require employers to check the immigration status of all employees, and another that would make it a federal crime to be an illegal immigrant in this country, and provide funding for local police, local law enforcement to enforce immigration laws. He'll go over some of those items. There's also a separate border security measure that's been passed out of the Homeland Security Committee. And then they're going to open up the floor. Members will be able to say what they want, how they want to see the House proceed, because really, it's going to be a tougher slog in the House. They don't have the same calculation that someone who represents an entire state does in terms of the growing diversity. A lot of these members are more concerned about a primary challenger, which I know I say on this program a lot, but a lot of them are more concerned about a primary challenger to their right than one to their left. And they don't necessarily have the same diversity in their districts. So there is a real lack of trust that the House could pass something and then not cave into everything that the Senate has in their bill. There's a lack of will for sure on a path to citizenship. Very few Republicans that I talk to have any interest in a path to citizenship. They sometimes say, maybe a path to legalization, but path to citizenship is really going to be very difficult to pass the House at any stage. Speaker Boehner needs to have this meeting so that then GOP leaders can decide the way forward. They need to feel like they have, I don't think that they want to move forward without the backing of their conference. Speaker Boehner's already assured them they will not bring up a package that does not have majority Republican support, so he's not going to bring up something and pass it with Democratic votes. And it's going to be unclear. We may see some action on some of those piecemeal bills this month. It may be September. But even that makes some members uncomfortable because it could lead to a conference with the Senate where the House could give in on a lot of provisions that they don't like.
Well, it's fascinating. We'll be following that and we'll check in with you again.
Sounds great.
Thanks, Jill. Jill Jackson is Capitol Hill producer for CBS News. This is Weekday. I'm Marcy Silman.
It's 9:20. Studying the effects of climate change on the Siberian Arctic in a minute.
Support for KUOW comes from Delta Dental, with a wide provider network that includes nearly 90% of Washington State dentists. More information and a list of participating dentists are available at deltadentalwa.com.
.58 degrees in Seattle. It's cloudy this morning, but the forecast says it's going to be sunny this afternoon. We expect to reach 79 degrees. Clear sky overnight, dropping to 60, and tomorrow, Tuesday, mostly sunny with a high of 82. I'm Bernard Ouellette. It's 9:21. Local nonprofit group Real Girls helps young women tell their stories through a variety of electronic media. We'll learn more about Real Girls by talking with the group's executive director in 20 minutes.
From 94.9 KUOW, I'm Marcy Silman. We hear a lot about the melting polar ice caps and other impacts of climate change. Most scientists agree that climate change does exist, but they're still collecting the data to prove it and to show how it's impacting the ecosystem. Undergraduate students and researchers travel to the Siberian Arctic every year. It's part of a month-long course that's called the Polaris Project. And part of that group of researchers will include a photographer, photojournalist Chris Linder. He joins the project later this summer, and he's in the studio with us right now. Thanks for coming in.
Thanks a lot.
I want to know first how a photojournalist fits into an environmental research project.
Well, my role is really to help the scientists communicate this research, which is can be a little bit difficult to get across to the lay public. And so I use images to help people kind of connect to what the scientists are doing, what they're, you know, not only the research that they're doing, but also just the logistics of how do you get to this remote corner of Siberia. How do you deal with the hordes of mosquitoes? Where do you live? What do you eat? All these things that people don't think about, I think, when they think about science. At least when I was growing up, it was, you know, science was done in a lab. It was, you know, you'd look at numbers on a spreadsheet. You didn't really think about people up to their waist in mud.
No, not really, unless you're thinking of Indiana Jones or something like that. Did you study science as a student?
I did. My background is in oceanography, so I studied oceanography as an undergraduate and then went on to get a master's degree from the Massachusetts Institute of Technology in ocean engineering.
And so when did the photography sort of dovetail with your science?
Yeah, that transition started to happen. It was a gradual transition. So about 15 years ago, I started working for Woods Hole Oceanographic as a research technician, and I would go out on the ships and helped scientists collect data. And when I was out there, I was also kind of indulging this passion I had for photography. And it wasn't just the pictures of, you know, beautiful sunsets and dolphins and things like that that the scientists were really interested in, but it was the pictures of the scientists themselves doing the work. And that was something that really was new, you know, because these expeditions, there's not really room for tourists.
I would guess not. We're talking with photojournalist Chris Linder, who, as you heard, has a science background, and we're joined now from somewhere in Siberia by Andy Bunn, who's a associate professor of environmental science at Western Washington University and a principal investigator with the Polaris Project. And Andy, where are you exactly?
Hi, good morning.
Hi.
I am on the Kolyma River in northeastern Siberia. Hello, can you hear me?
Yes, I can. Yes, I can. Sorry, I had to wheel across the floor to do something technical. So that is where exactly? Northeastern Russia?
It's far northeastern Russia, above the Arctic Circle. It's 8 time zones east of Moscow. So, I mean, to think about the scale of that, I think if you go 8 time zones east of Seattle, you're in Paris. So it's a you know, virtually a different country than European Russia, and it's 4 a.m. here, and the sun is just moving around in a circle. It never sets, and I'm standing out on the back of a barge, which we live on for a month doing research, and looking out at the Kolyma River, which is one of the largest rivers in the Arctic, flowing north towards the Arctic River, towards the Arctic Ocean.
And how long have you and the current group of students been there?
We've only been here for about a week right now, which is amazing. You know, we left Seattle and took what became 3 and then 4 consecutive red-eye flights to get out here. And we've been out here we've been on the ground here for about 5 days now. And everyone's sort of woken up and adjusted to the time change and to the, you know, the amount of travel we're doing. And we've got undergraduate students who are working on research projects, developing their own research projects. And we have reconnecting with our international science colleagues, our Russian colleagues, and Dutch colleagues, and British colleagues, and unpacking equipment and getting ready to really start doing the science that we've come here to do.
And what specifically is that science this summer?
So we're interested in understanding how carbon gets transported and transformed as it moves from the uplands and the boreal forest out to the Arctic Ocean via these large rivers. Ultimately, our research relates into how the climate behaves and what's happening to the forests and the soils as the climate up here warms. I mean, it's the climate up here has warmed dramatically, and the amount of carbon that's locked up in these permafrost soils, these permanently frozen soils, is potentially able to change a great deal as the climate warms. And we're trying to understand exactly how that's going to take place.
Now, Andy, how many summers have you been traveling to this area?
I think this is the sixth year we've done the Polaris Project, and I've been on, I've been on five of those six over the last several years. So I've traveled up here many times.
And how? What kinds of changes have you seen over those years?
Well, it's interesting. The changes we see. There's a lot of variation from year to year. I was struck walking around a lake that I've traveled around with Chris Linder, as you guessed, Chris, many times, and the banks of this lake have eroded as permafrost has warmed and slumped into the waterways. A forest that I've worked in and been sort of walking through to get to this lake is dying off as the lake bank slumps. But it really varies tremendously from year to year. It's incredibly hot here right now. It was over 90 degrees yesterday.
Wow!
And it's supposed to be that hot all week. But I've been up here in other years in July where it snowed on us. So it's the weather is tremendously variable, and the climate is tremendously variable. But the trend is towards increasing warmth.
Well, Andy, I'm going to let you get back to enjoying the sun at 4 a.m., which I believe it's 4 a.m. Tuesday where you are. Andy is an associate associate professor of environmental science at Western Washington University. Andy Bunn is a principal investigator with the Polaris Project, and he joined us from Siberia. Thanks so much.
Thanks, Marcy. I would like to quickly say happy birthday to my son, Sam, who is turning 11, and I miss him very much.
Happy birthday to Sam Bunn. Thanks, Andy. We continue our conversation about the Polaris Project with photojournalist Chris Linder. And Andy mentioned 90 degrees standing on the edge of this lake in Siberia. How many years have you gone up there?
Well, this August, this will be my third summer there. I've also gone to the Lena River in March. So I've seen kind of the two seasons. This year I'll be going in the fall, so that'll be a different experience.
When I hear Siberian Arctic, I think of sort of icebergs and ice flows. I guess maybe my image is of the South Pole. But I'm curious, Andy talked about what he's seen. Changes. What changes have you documented with your camera and with your eyes over the 3 years you've been visiting?
Well, some of the things that are really, really obvious there are you see obvious evidence of changes are in the landscape itself changing. What you see is, along some of the riverbanks, you can see exposed ice wedges, which are really the soil there is permafrost soil, which can extend up to 1,500 meters down into the ground. And this is soil that's frozen from year to year. And it's basically like rock. I mean, you can tap on it with a little hammer, and it sounds like rock, but it looks like mud. And there are some places on the particular riverbanks where you can see that, you can see these exposed ice wedges. You're basically looking back in time. It's like a time machine. Hmm. The base of those, you're seeing little bits of debris of bone from the Pleistocene era. So there's, basically like a little frozen time machine there. And what's really unique about this soil, too, is, and the reason why these scientists have traveled this far to go to this particular part of the Arctic is that this soil is very rich in carbon, as Andy mentioned. So rich, I mean, this is a statistic that always blows me away when I hear it, is that if you take all of the forests on Earth and you add up all the carbon in all those forests, there's four times as much carbon in the soil in the Arctic, just in the soil, four times as much than if you add up all the forests on Earth put together.
So what does that carbon tell scientists?
Well, really what they're concerned about is this: the carbon, as this permafrost, it's basically like if you take this permafrost and it has previously been frozen, and now as climate warms, it's like taking meat out of the freezer. Mm-hmm. Right? It's thawing. And as it thaws, just like meat that you take out of the freezer, it becomes available to be food by microbes that previously didn't have that food. So as they munch on this ancient carbon, they're They're kind of burping out carbon dioxide and methane. And these are potent greenhouse gases, so you can see how this is going to lead to this feedback effect where it's putting more of these gases into the atmosphere. And scientists kind of refer to this part of the Arctic as a potential carbon bomb that's waiting to go off, and that this is a lot of carbon stored in that permafrost.
So you mentioned before Andy joined us, sort of came from outer space or came from Siberia via sat phone to join us, that when you started off, you were a scientist and you were indulging your photographic hobby, but that in a sense, you view what you do as sort of an interpreter for what the scientists are doing. So how does that play out on a project like Polaris?
Well, I interview the undergraduates about their experience in the field. I interview the scientists when I go in the field, and I kind of weave that together with images that I take into these narratives that basically the scientists are telling the story, but I kind of help them along, help them because they're really good at communicating with their peers. But over the years, they've gotten so good at developing this shorthand method of interacting with their peers that it becomes difficult to translate that science into words, really simple words that everybody can understand. And so in the hours and hours of interviews that I do, I distill that down to several minute videos that we then put online to communicate the science to the public.
So your job then is really to make it sort of a mass communication of, mm-hmm. of something that's very technical.
Yeah, I want to make it real. I want to connect people not just to the science, but to the scientists themselves. I could tell the story, I could narrate it, but I really want to hear their voices tell the story. I want to hear in their words, why do they want to go, get eaten by mosquitoes for a month? What drives them to do these things? Why do they feel that passion to do this?
What does drive them?
It's I think it comes down to this simple curiosity. They have this almost childlike curiosity that some people lose later in life, but I think scientists just are like little kids almost. They just retain this questioning nature, and I have a 6-year-old and a 3-year-old, and they just continually, but why, asking these questions. And I see scientists in kind of the same light. They have this, they just haven't lost that innate curiosity to know the answers, to figure it out.
What seems unique about this project, Polaris, is that undergraduates are going. We hear a lot about, especially doctoral candidates who are out with their professors doing field work. How is what the undergrads, or how is the approach of an undergraduate student different than somebody who is a PhD candidate?
This is a really neat aspect of Polaris, I think, and something that's really makes it a really cool project is that these students come with almost no bias, that some of them have never left the country before. They get a passport for the first time to travel to this place, this corner of Russia, and they really get hooked on it. And it's difficult to do research in Russia. There's a lot of paperwork that's involved, red tape. There's the difficulty of getting there, of setting up an experiment. They have to improvise. I've seen them in the field taking, buckets and syringes and different tools to make measurements. There's no Walmart around the corner. There's no Home Depot where you can go build an instrument if you need it. They really have to learn this kind of creative side of science and how to take what you've got and solve the problem that you're given, this kind of creative on-the-spot problem solving that's a big part of science.
Well, how does that play out for you? I mean, you also don't have access to someplace if your cameras should break or your audio equipment.
I've always got a lot of backups, a lot of spares.
Yeah. Are you traveling with like duffel bags full of technical equipment?
I'm pretty proud of how light I can travel. I typically carry about 120 pounds or so of gear. That includes boots, wetsuit, underwater camera gear, everything. You've got to travel through a lot of airports in Russia. It's a big project. It takes several days just to get to Chersky.
And when are you leaving?
I'm leaving on August 20th for about 2.5 weeks.
And so that you'll be with a new group of students than the ones Andy Bunn is with now?
That's right. So it'll be this year they decided to kind of split the experience into several different teams. And so I'll be going with the team that's known as the carbon bomb team. So we'll be going, I'll be traveling with two researchers from Woods Hole Research Center and then one undergraduate And so we'll be taking small boats out on the rivers and traveling all over this area of the Siberian Arctic sampling.
So how does this fit in with that early prep that you had done to become a scientist, which I assume was what your initial goal starting out in your adult life was?
I mean, my experiences, I think, have been invaluable. I couldn't do this job, I don't think, if I hadn't had this perspective on science. And it really, you know, I think the advice I give to any photographer, and a lot of people ask me, how do I get your job? I said, well, become a scientist first, because this will give you the perspective you need on how to photograph it, you know, how to interact with scientists, you know, how to keep out of their way when they're doing stuff. I never stage a shot. You know, I'm pretty good at being unobtrusive and kind of a fly on the wall as they're doing their work. Because I understand what it takes to write a grant. You know, it may take 2-3 years to get into the field. It takes all this effort to get there to do the work. The most important thing is not to disturb the work that's going on.
What is the most surprising thing that you have photographed on these jaunts out into places that most of us will never see?
Well, I remember the first, I think everybody in the Polaris Project would say the same thing, is that when you first land on the beach at this eroding riverbank called Devani Yar, and you put your feet in the mud, it's almost like quicksand. And so our host there, Sergei Zimov, is this kind of icon of research in Siberia, and he's lived there for, I think, 25 years or so.
Permanently he lives there?
He lives there, yeah, year round. And, you know, he gives this lecture about how to escape from the quicksand of this kind of gooey muck of this melting mud that's coming off of the river, you know, off into the banks of the river. And he says, oh, how to build a bridge, and you leave your boots and you crawl like a crocodile to get out of the mud. And, you know, he finishes his lecture with, it's most important to be survivor, he says.
Not
so dangerous to be dirty.
Have you had to crawl like a crocodile out of the mud?
I've never had to crawl out, but I've had the mud over my boots and had to pull them out with two hands, you know, to pull out your boots as you kind of sink into. If you got to kind of dance quickly across the mud to get to safe areas. But then as you walk along, too, you'll see, you know, bones just coming out of the mud, mammoth bones.
It's like giant.
Pleistocene horses. I mean, you know, skulls of bison, things like this. So it's just a otherworldly experience. And there's these kind of pyramids of soil that look like termite mounds. And that's what's left as the ice, that icy soil kind of melts away. It's bizarre.
And so we will see photographs in all kinds of journals, or are the ones that you take up for Polaris at specifically the Polaris website?
Yeah, the Polaris website is thepolarisproject.org, and that has a lot of photographs and videos over my previous two trips, 2009, 2010. And I'll be going this fall to make more videos about the team and what they're doing.
Chris Linder is an award-winning photojournalist. His work has appeared as well as at the Polaris website in publications including Wired and Geo. And as you heard, he'll be traveling on to wherever this place is in the Siberian Arctic in late August. Thank you so much for coming in today.
Thanks very much for having me.
This is KUOW. I'm Marcy Silman.
In a minute here, a conversation about empowering girls through media and storytelling. The executive director of local nonprofit Real Girls joins us in a minute on KUOW 94.9 Seattle. Well, here in Seattle this morning, it's pretty cloudy, 59 degrees right now, expecting sun this afternoon, and a high today of 79.
On the next Living on Earth, what's happening under the earth in Bayou Corn, Louisiana?
Come home to check on the house, make sure everything was okay, and I noticed there were bubbles in the yard. You could feel the pressure of the bubbles coming out of the ground. It's nerve-wracking.
The perils of living with a massive sinkhole. I'm Steve Kerwood, and that's next time on Living on Earth from PRI.
Tonight at 10 on KUOW.
Support for KUOW comes from the Northwest Traverse Series, featuring two multi-sport relays for solo and teams to include running, paddling, mountain biking, and road biking, the Olympia Traverse on July 27th, and the Peace Health Bellingham Traverse on September 21st. Registration at northwesttraverse.com.
941. I'm Bernard Ouellette. The Puget Sound area will keep losing Boeing jobs. Steve Wilhelm, local business journalist, will tell us why in 25 minutes.
From 94.9 KUOW Seattle, I'm Marcy Silman. Years ago, back when cigarette makers could advertise on television, Virginia Slims had a memorable spot that was aimed at women smokers. "You've come a long way, baby," it crowed. Well, flash forward several decades, and there are many people who'd argue that women haven't really made the kind of progress toward gender equality that some would like to see. And that's part of the mission behind Seattle's Real Girls, to empower girls from diverse communities to realize their power through media production. Robin Held has led Real Girls for a little over a year now, and she joins me in the studio. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you for the invitation.
That was my sort of dilution of your mission statement, but pretty close. Maybe you want to expand a little bit from your vantage point. What is Real Girls?
Can I say a little bit by saying something about how it began?
Sure.
And the kind of role it has now.
Yeah.
Which is a little bit different. So when Real Girls was founded about 12 years ago by Mallory Graham and a number of close educators and artists, they saw a great need to change an industry, and their work was really focused on the filmmaking industry, getting more women behind the camera, getting more women with the kinds of skills to move up the ladder, and to change what were really disheartening numbers. Mm. Very few feature films being made by women, very few plum roles with women in them, and then therefore very few, I'm using quotes here, women's stories being told. Those figures have not changed very much.
I was just going to say that this is, 12 years since since then? But
and it's, while that is still a focus of Real Girls, I think what we've been trying to embrace more fully in the last several years is the wide range of media making that is part of our landscape, especially the wide range in our city of technological innovation and change. And there are so many possibilities, career possibilities, artistic possibilities for young women, even in our own city, above and beyond filmmaking.
Does media literacy itself fit into what you guys do?
Very much so. And that's, I think that's in some ways most related to your opening remarks, because Real Girls not only teaches girls the hard and soft skills of digital media making, but also critical awareness about the images that surround them every day. And I think that's where we may all be seeing an additional pressure on this generation of young women, because they are surrounded at all times by conflicting messages. And in some more traditional media, like family films or television and online, the kinds of messages they get, they don't see. Let's go back to the kind of phrase, you can only see what you can only want to be what you see,
yeah,
however that goes. but there are still so, in family films, there are far more men in roles, boys in speaking roles, than there are women. So there's still, the representation is really out of balance with a society where women are half the workforce, half the population.
We're talking with Robin Held of Real Girls. In looking at the website, you see girls that look pretty young. I'm wondering what the lowest age is and who exactly you're serving. Mm.
Real Girls says now that it serves ages 9 to 21, but some people fib to get in. So we've had some really smart 8-year-olds making extraordinary projects as a curator. My past is being a museum curator. And in that role, my job was really to bring help artists realize their most ambitious projects. It is a thrill for me to see really creative 9-year-olds, 10-year-olds, 12-year-olds, before someone really tells them no, that they learn the permission and that they learn that making really changes how you see the world. That I know in my bones, if I know anything.
How many participate?
that if you think about the concentric circles of Real Girls, there's the media lab where mm-hmm. the classes take place. That's probably 250 to 300 girls a year. Then we have an apprenticeship program where girls who have been taught to tell their own stories and make their own media, it changes and they begin to learn to tell other organizations' stories. They begin to learn about other nonprofits or to tell stories of others. Then they move into something called Real Girls Productions, which is our production company.
Wow.
And there they work with female mentors to produce client videos. So that's really workforce development. We are an Adobe Youth Voices strategic partner, which is an international alliance of Adobe Foundation. So all those things combined, we probably serve 1,700 to 2,000 youth, boys and girls, in the region.
That's a pretty big population, and I bet there's more that want to come in and do this. I had read somewhere that Real Girls was the first program of its kind that was aimed at young women. Is that true?
It was.
And
it was.
Are there a lot more now?
There are several now, and several focusing on different aspects. For example, there are a number of different organizations who teach girls to code. Mm-hmm. And Real Girls will soon be teach. We teach animation courses. We teach a lot of things, but not specifically coding. There are those who focus on filmmaking. There are those who have different, different aspects, whether it's social justice, mm-hmm. or whether it's storytelling, or whether it's media activism, or if it's experimental art making. I would say Real Girls has tracks in all those things.
So the mentors, are there enough women to have a sole female mentorship?
We have different kinds of mentors depending on the jobs. So, for example, in the classroom, and one of the things that distinguishes Real Girls programs is a high degree of mentors to students and really high youth engagement. And what that means is that it's not a mentor telling you what to do. It's working with you to help you discover what you want to do. Those are often educators.
Mm.
As we move up that chain to the apprenticeship program and into Real Girls Productions, there are women with different skills and then mixed teams. In the Real Girls Productions, it's a little bit more like the real world, where men and women are working with youth to produce client videos.
You know, we were talking just a bit ago when I introduced you as saying that there aren't really gender equality. It's not a place where we're at this point, at least from my vantage point. And a lot of other women might feel that same way. And so When Mallory Graham started this in 2001, looking to help women portray themselves, mm-hmm. or young women portray themselves, from you coming from the outside and then taking over this job, are women really portraying themselves in a wider array, a wider arena than Real Girls? The goal that in 2001 of helping women tell their stories, because their mm-hmm. stories weren't being told, the very simplest, most basic building block of Real Girls. It seems that there's still a ways to go, even though you've got, 1,700 to 2,000 people participating.
There's a long ways to go. I think gender representation is a really complex arena because we're not just talking about, one, seeing more women and seeing more speaking active women, women in leadership roles. We're also talking about less restrictive notions of what a woman can do. I think the goal many organizations have, lots of us in the world, are to get to a place where there's so many women in roles of leadership. We don't say woman leader, yeah. woman artist, woman diplomat. It's just leadership that we're talking about. We have a ways to go.
You mentioned, Robin, that you were a museum curator before you took this job. You were a museum curator for many years before you took this job. It's a big change, it would seem, at least from the outside looking in. So what tempted you to leave a position that, hundreds of people covet?
On any day, I would probably tell that story in different ways. I loved being a curator. It could be that I'm a curator again. I love making exhibitions. For those of you who don't know what a curator does, it's almost like making a feature film or an opera, but you're doing it in the form of objects that have been borrowed from around the world or commissioned and put in one place and one time for people to come see. It requires a lot of scholarship, negotiation, and then an accumulation of certain objects and its bodies and space organized in very specific ways. I love that work very much. The most, as a curator of contemporary art, the most rewarding part of my job was always working directly with artists. And much of what I did was work with women artists and women artists in new fields, in, and I'm using quotes again, new media, whatever that was. So much of my work was with artists, women artists who were working in robotics or in artificial intelligence or in transgenic bacteria or any number of new media. So it wasn't so much of a leap to begin working with young people working in new mediums. I think people who work in time-based mediums, they think differently, and I'm seeing that in young people now. It's a new, it's a really privileged position to see young artists developing now, and I look forward to the kind of work they produce in 10 and 15 years.
I know at the Frye Museum, which was your most recent curatorial position, there were youth outreach programs. I mean, part of what you did was to try to bring kids and people who work with kids into the walls of the museum, but now you're really in that, well, I'm not sure how one-on-one you are. You're sort of leading the one-on-one charge, but there must have been some challenges for you professionally, personally as well, perhaps. I don't know.
Where should we go with that?
What was hard?
Well, here's my job at the Frye. I'll start from there. I was both a chief curator and we were working toward big change, big transformation in the museum. And the museum I came to was very different than the museum I left. And those changes required work at the level of the state. It was quite rewarding work. So moving to Real Girls was, in a way, acknowledging a different kind of transformation that was possible out in the world, transforming Real Girls from an excellent idea and a very strong foundation to an organization that can steward this work with agility and flexibility and strength into the future, because these issues are not going away. That's a big part of my job. And that was the challenge, too, following a founder and building the next almost the first floor, making the first floor strong enough to support the second floor and beyond.
So ultimately, in your view, there is a mission statement on the website, which I paraphrase. But what, you know, where do you see Real Girls in 5 years or 10 years?
It's possible now to say that Seattle is a media arts education destination.
Wow.
It isn't branded that way, but it's true. Everyone's not talking to each other, but it's true. I look forward to Real Girls being at the center of that kind of destination, branded very clearly, because this is where the first PhD program in new media was produced. This is MCDM. There's DX Arts. There are film schools. There's all kind of technological innovation and creativity. And I want Real Girls as part of that conversation. I also want the girls at Real Girls to see a wide range of careers and education possibilities that they might not see otherwise. I really hope that this generation we're training now become some great leaders in our region and beyond. In fields we can't imagine yet. I mean, the tools change all the time. The idea of girls is changing all the time. I think that's what makes it a really exciting place to be.
So what hurdles do you have to getting to that?
Hurdles. Things are changing. Things are changing for women and girls, and they're not changing fast enough. In our lifetime, we have laws for equal rights. We have laws for equal pay. I say very clearly that I'm a feminist, and I say that Real Girls is working toward a feminist future. And I use the F word because what we're talking about is equality. We are talking about an equal playing field, and we have a long ways to go. And that's the biggest challenge. And I'm really honored to be part of that work, making tomorrow better for girls and women.
So on the practical level, I know during the school year, this is an after school mm-hmm. event, but we're talking in the midst of a heat wave. So it's summertime and you guys have camps and abundant programs. And I wondered if anybody listening to this all of a sudden, you know, sits up from the couch and says, I want to do that, if it's even possible for them this summer.
It is still possible. I recommend going to the website and looking at the wide array of programs coming up for 9 to 12-year-olds and for teens. And if you don't get up off the couch really quickly, there are some other exciting opportunities to learn more about Real Girls this summer. Real Girls will have a very large presence at Bumbershoot in the Northwest Rooms, and that would be the very best place to come see. We'll have performance and video and all kinds of new work, new media, and lots of good times.
Robin, you are somebody I think of as all-knowing and competent, but something must have really surprised you about Real Girls when you took over, and I'm wondering what that was. So I should say here that Robin had to look at the ceiling and think over all the surprises that took over. So anything, I mean, it could be something that delighted you as well, surprised you.
It's a pleasure every day to see young girls make and to move from that giggly, shy moment when they're with other 9-year-old strangers to the time they come together and they create something. And by the end of a week-long camp, there's the fidgeting. The fidgeting is, can we just hurry up? And I got to get the editing done. We have to get this done. The focus becomes on the work. What I would say about Real Girls and the field it operates in, it's a very interesting place to be because the tools are changing all the time. Our notions of gender are changing, and therefore the notion of what a girl is changing. And our ideas about educating young people are changing. So I feel like it's a kind of shifting ground we're operating on with our sights on the North Star of equality.
Robin Held is director of Real Girls. Thank you so much for coming in.
Oh, thank you. It was a pleasure to be with you.
And now, the sound of the day. Well, the 4th of July is over, but you might be hearing this sound in your neighborhood still. Our listener Liz sent us this recording over the holiday weekend, and as you can tell, it's firecrackers going off in her South Everett neighborhood. And this was actually recorded on the 4th of July, but Liz says the recording barely captures the actual noise. It seems pretty close to the night soundscape that we've been listening to.
Indeed, it does.
Still, people have stockpiled those firecrackers. If you're setting them off, do be careful, as always. What interesting sounds are you listening to? We'd love for you to record 30 seconds of what you hear and send that sound to us, along with the story behind the sound. You can email your audio file to weekday@kuow.org, and be sure to include sound of the day in the subject line, and maybe it'll be more peaceful as everybody's firecrackers wear off. Bernard, in the next hour, we're going to talk a little bit about Boeing, and then Nancy Pearl will be in to talk about books for young readers.
Excellent.
Yep, looking forward to it.
It's all coming up. Thanks. It is 9:59. Washington State transportation officials are talking about making ferry rides more expensive. We'll have more on that in the news in a minute. KUOW-FM Seattle, KUOW Tumwater, KQOW Bellingham, and Digital HD Services.
Just in time to examine the NSA's.
Thanks for listening. The program you just heard was made possible by the financial support of our listeners. Support this program and others like it by making a pledge today at kuow.org.